Finally, the landing gear bumped onto the deck, and Takela closed the throttle, stilling the thrum of the engine before slumping forward with a soft sigh. She sat with her head resting on the dials, in what Lizanne suspected was a theatrical pose, until she heard a very faint snore emerge from the girl's nose. At any other time, signing this would be an unconscionable act. Trumaine sighed before tossing the contract onto his desk. One the syndicate would most likely punish with a prison sentence. Now, however... He shrugged and sank into his seat. Lizanne had expected more resistance from him, but divined that his pragmatism outweighed any ingrained corporatist abhorrence for such a patently poor deal. There is something else to consider, she said. The contract makes no mention of you. Trumaine frowned at her. So? It stipulates just about every aspect of our arrangement, including my role and the role of our coterie of inventors, and the employment of the refugees, but says nothing about you, the man they refer to as Captain Noose. I believe this to be a deliberate omission. Captain, I must advise you not to accompany us into Verestian waters. Take the viable opportunity and head north, along with Mrs. Griffin. If you can make it to a Mandalorian port, you can enlighten what's left of the syndicate hierarchy on the true nature of this crisis. Such understanding appears to be sadly lacking at this juncture. No. Trumaine gave a stiff shake of his head. I have not led this fleet so far to abandon it. They'll hang you, Lizanne broke in. The O'Canis family and many of the other clans feel they owe you a blood debt, something Verestians do not forgive. I have never run from pirates, Miss Lethbridge, he replied in a quiet but steady voice that told her this discussion was over. I do not intend to start now. He lowered his gaze to the charts unfurled on his desk, reaching for a pen and compass. Now, I have a course to plot, if you'll excuse me. The whole composition has 8 distinct movements, Macario said, handing her a partially crumpled sheaf of musical notation. It was realizing this that proved the key. The artisan certainly had a passion for the number 8. Glancing over the papers, Lizanne found them covered in a mostly illegible scrawl of notes, interspersed with comments in the musician's often tiny script. Lifting her gaze to him, she was struck by the redness of his eyes, and the jittery tremble to his hand as he ran it through a mop of unkempt hair. How long since you slept? She asked. His brow bunched in genuine bafflement. Why would I sleep with a puzzle like this to solve? I once thought Ilmont would be my soul-consuming passion, but this... He turned his gaze to the solograph, and Lizanne found herself wondering about the ability of this device to capture the hearts of those cursed to study it. The artisan was as much a musician as he was an inventor. To have met him would have been to know greatness. You're sure this is all of it? She asked, setting the pages down on the workbench. I've tested it several times, out of earshot of our fellow convict, of course. Very well. Lizanne turned to regard Tinkerer, who stood at another bench near the starboard bulkhead. He was engaged in completing a prototype redesign of the rocket projectile that had been so useful during the march from Skorazin. This one was larger with a greatly increased range, and, thanks to an internal clockwork apparatus of dizzying complexity, would possess a remarkable level of accuracy. We'll wait until he's finished his new toy, she said. In the meantime, please get some rest. 3 days later, she watched Tinkerer's face closely as the solograph played the tune, deciding Macario had been right about the artisan's musical gifts matching his inventiveness. After he tapped out the first 3 movements on the chimes, the device began to play on its own. Cogs whirred and dials turned, as it gave voice to something of such somber precision but it couldn't help but tug at her heart. Tinkerer sat through it all with an expression of interest, but no particular concern, and when he was done, his only reaction was to blink at her. "Have you," Lizanne ventured, "anything to tell me?"
"Yes,"
he said with an earnest nod that caused her to lean closer.
"I need more brass for the rocket guidance mechanism."
"About this," she grated, stabbing a finger at the solograph.
"About all of this?"
"Oh," said Tinkerer.
"Then no."
"It's the right tune," Macario insisted, as Lizanne turned her gaze upon him. She thought back over her interactions with Tinkerer, all mentions of the artisan and his shared memories in the trance. The trance.
"Here,"
she said, taking a vial of blue from her wallet.
"Play it again,"
she instructed Macario, after she and Tinkerer had both imbibed equal portions of the product. This time the reaction was immediate. As soon as the tune began, Tinkerer's gaze took on the unfocused cast that told of an imminent trance. However, it wasn't until the fourth movement that the full effect took hold. Tinkerer's eyes closed, and he slumped to the floor, limbs twitching. Lizanne began to rise from her seat to check on him, and found herself standing waist-deep in the middle of a fast-flowing river. She had never experienced such a seamless transition into the trance state before, and found it jarring. The sudden switch in surroundings, complete with a change in temperature, sights, smells, and sounds, made her stagger in the water. She would have lost her footing on the loose shingle of the riverbed if a pair of hands hadn't reached out to steady her.
"Careful now,"
said a voice in soft, cultured Eutherian.
"You really can drown in here, you know."
The woman who had hold of her arms was trimly built, of average height, with shrewd dark eyes peering at Lizanne from behind a pair of spectacles. She wore sturdy clothes of strong fabric, the kind worn by someone who spends a good deal of time outdoors. A heavy pack was slung over her shoulders, and a short-brimmed felt hat sat on her head, tilted back to reveal a shock of close-cropped black hair. She was also, Lizanne noticed, possessed of a high-cheekboned beauty, normally reserved for the imaginary heroines found adorning the covers of cheap romance novels.
"This,"
Lizanne closed her eyes and shook her befuddled head before taking a more fulsome look at her surroundings. A swift river, thick jungle on both banks.
"This is the Aratian interior."
"It is indeed."
The woman gave an apologetic smile and released Lizanne's arms from her gentle but firm grasp.
"Though I have always preferred the Eutherian name for the continent, Kilnaria. It derives from a serpent god of the pre-imperial era. Quite apt, wouldn't you agree, miss?"
"Lethbridge,"
she said, straightening and extending her hand.
"Lizanne Lethbridge, and yes, very apposite.
Alastine Akiv Askarian,"
the woman said, shaking her head and giving a formal bow.
"I was about to stop for lunch,"
she went on, sloshing her way towards the far bank.
"If you would care to join me."
"You are the artisan?"
Lizanne asked, voicing a rueful laugh as she labored through the water in her wake. The trance had seen fit to attire her in a somewhat impractical skirt and jacket of archaic dimensions, making for laggardly progress.
"The artisan was a woman."
"How observant you are,"
Alastine remarked, clambering onto the riverbank and extending a hand as Lizanne struggled to extricate herself from the water.
"I thought you would already know my name,"
Lizanne said, hauling herself free of the river and keeping hold of Alastine's hand.
"The artisan having foreseen this meeting." "The mad artisan,"
Alastine said, a smile now tinged with a mix of sadness and humor.
"Isn't that what they will come to call me?"
"The appellation of madness has faded recently,"
Lizanne replied.
"Which is strange,
given that the world around us grows madder by the day. Alastine released her hand and turned, leading her deeper into the jungle.
I did not, in fact, know your name, she told Lizanne, as they tracked along a narrow trail. But I have foreseen this meeting, or at least a portion of it. Oddly, I remember you having darker hair, and being markedly less polite. It happens sometimes. The vision's truth proves illusory. Due, I have theorized, to the relative passage of time. The longer I have to wait for it to come true, the less true it turns out to be.
What did we discuss in the vision? Lizanne asked, aware that her voice betrayed a note of desperation she would normally try to conceal. The shock of actually finding herself conversing with this person, after expending so much time and effort to do so, made her a little giddy, even nervous.
You said your world was burning,
Alastine said, coming to a halt as the trail opened out into a broad clearing. She unslung her pack and set it down, before casting around with a searching gaze.
We need firewood, if you wouldn't mind lending a hand.
Lizanne began to comply, but found her eyes drawn to a dark shape above the treetops ahead, the side's jagged black teeth against the pale blue of the sky. The temple, she realized, recalling one of Clay's shared memories.
Are we close to Crystalline Lake? She inquired. Oh, Emperor's soul, no.
Alastine laughed, crouching to gather up a fallen branch.
The lake lies over 300 miles northeast of here.
She followed Lizanne's gaze to the bulky silhouette above the trees.
Seen one like it before, I see. Crystalline Lake, eh? I must confess, I had no idea there were ruins there.
A whole city, in fact.
One I'll never get to see, except through your eyes, if you're willing to share.
Lizanne turned to her, finding the same half-sad, half-amused smile on her lips. It wasn't unkind, but Lizanne found there was too much knowledge behind that smile for her to like it.
So in your vision, I told you my world was burning, she said. In reality, it has only just begun to smolder, though I think the flames are about to rise very high indeed. I believe you know how to prevent that, and I would have you tell me.
Alastine's smile switched to a grimace, her face clouding in reflective sorrow.
Then I fear you may be disappointed, miss. But...
She dumped the branch she had gathered on the ground and set about searching for more.
Let's discuss it over dinner, shall we? I have an excellent cut of Serath haunch to share. It's good meat, but does require proper seasoning.
She proved deaf to further questions, so Lizanne helped her build the fire and a frame with which to spit the haunch of meat. Alastine scored the layer of fat coating the flesh with a knife, then rubbed it with salt before sprinkling on some wild thyme. She constructed the frame in only a few moments, crafting 2 sturdy bipods and a crossbeam from scavenged wood. The swift, unconscious precision with which she went about the task was enough to banish any doubts Lizanne might have as to her identity.
She looks like Tinkerer, she realized, or Father when he's particularly engrossed. The secret is to keep it turning,
Alastine said, adjusting the haunch's position over the fire before turning to her pack.
Would you care for an aperitif?
She extracted a metal flask and 2 tin cups, handing one to Lizanne before pouring a pinkish liquid into it.
A local vintage,
Alastine said, raising her own cup to her nose to sample the aroma.
I'm afraid the name is quite unpronounceable. I call it Calnaria's Milk.
Lizanne sniffed the substance, finding it pleasantly fruity, before taking a sip.
Very nice, she said, if a little strong for my tastes. I'm glad you like it. You didn't in the vision.
She drained her own cup and poured some more.
So, how did you like the music? I assume you unlocked the solograph. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. A highly accomplished tune, to be sure. The musician I employed to decipher it was suitably impressed, and he is something of an expert in the music of your era. And you, Miss Lethbridge, did you like it?
There was a weight to Alastine's gaze that caused Lizanne to conclude her answer was important.
A test of some kind? She wondered. Did my vision self hate the music or love it?
It was beautiful, she said, deciding honesty would be the best course. But sad. Your musical skills appear to match your flair for things mechanical.
I can assure you they do not. I didn't write the music, you see. I merely captured it for posterity, although it's nice to know my flair for the mechanical had some uses.
A great many uses. So many, in fact, people have killed to possess the fruits of your labor, myself included.
Such was never my intention.
Alastine took another sip from her cup and turned to the meat, asking Lizanne to help as she adjusted the spit to revolve the haunch above the flames.
Approach every task with care and diligence, and you won't go far wrong, she said. Something my mother never tired of telling me.
If you didn't write the music, Lizanne said, stepping back to waft the thickening smoke away,
who did?
She saw the sadness return to Alastine's face, but this time it was not accompanied by any humor.
A lady of my prior acquaintance, she said. You remind me a little of her. So much passion and humanity bound up in a tight, controlled package. I think you two would have gotten on quite well, although in time she would probably have come to see you as a threat and had you executed. She was prone to such things in later life, so I'm told.
Had me executed? Lizanne asked. A woman of some influence, then?
You could say that. They made her empress eventually. Well, emperor, to be strictly accurate. Apparently the title cannot accommodate a change in gender.
A singular memory sprang to the fore of Lizanne's mind. One of the many statues adorning the miniature temples that lay outside the Corventine Imperial Sanctum. A hawk-nosed woman rendered in marble.
The Empress Azareth, she said.
You knew her? She wrote the music.
She wrote a great many things, but music was her passion. And yes, I knew her. But she wasn't an empress then.
There was a rustle of disturbed vegetation as Alastine turned towards the far end of the clearing, Lizanne following her gaze to see the foliage twisting and merging to form a new tableau. A young woman sat at a pianola, playing the same tune the artisan had captured in the solograph. Although the surrounding jungle remained unchanged, the floor beneath the pianola was smooth, checkered marble, reflecting a grand, palatial interior. Despite her youth, Lizanne saw clearly the resemblance to the stern, commanding woman who would later adorn the temple built in her honor.
She was just a lonely girl then,
Alastine went on, as the young future empress played her beautifully sad music.
Lost in a court of privileged, scheming idiots who would quite happily have seen her dead. I've often thought divine blood was more a curse than a blessing. So much promise, so much more music to give to the world, all swallowed up by the fate her blood made for her. But the young are ever prone to the hope, perhaps the delusion, that their fate can be changed.
Lizanne watched as a young woman emerged from the jungle and bowed to the woman at the pianola, who immediately straightened into a much more attentive posture. The younger Alastine was also easy to recognize, but in this memory she wore the white blouse, black waistcoat and skirt of a Corventine court attendant, and a low-ranking one at that.
It's the upper C minor again, I'm afraid,
Azareth said, tapping one of the pianola's keys.
A little tinny, don't you think? My musical knowledge was only functional.
The older Alastine told Lizanne, as her younger self opened the lid of the pianola.
I knew enough to repair instruments, but not play them with any skill. My primary duty in the sanctum was fixing the various toys and automata with which the noble children amused themselves. The fiddly girl, they called me, amongst other things.
She gave a fond chuckle.
Awful brats, the lot of them, apart from one.
At the young Alastine's bidding, Azarel repeatedly tapped the key as she worked away at something in the pianola's innards. Lizanne was no expert, but couldn't detect more than a fractional change in the pitch.
I found out later she used to loosen the strings herself,
the older Alastine said,
just so she would have a reason to talk to me. That seems perfect, my lady,
her younger self said, closing the pianola lid and dropping into a low curtsy.
If you'll excuse me. Wait a moment,
Azarel said.
I've been working on a little something and would so like your opinion. My lady attendants wouldn't know a decent tune if I strangled them with it.
She began to play without waiting for a response. The same composition as before, but now executed with expert clarity and precision. Lizanne found it much more affecting than that recreated by the Sodograph's chimes. Music that seemed to reach inside her, forcing her mind to explore the most vibrant memories, good and bad. It was both an unnerving and intoxicating experience, and, judging by the changing expression on the young Alastine's face, one she shared in full measure. Up until now, her face had maintained the same incurious, carefully neutral mode common to servants of long standing. Now she stared at the young woman before her with rapt fascination, a single tear tracing down her cheek.
Love is always a surprise,
the older Alastine said.
Don't you find? Whether it creeps up on you over the course of years, or reaches out to snare you in an instant, the moment is always a revelation, and it can happen in the space of a heartbeat, or the time it takes to play the most wondrous music a foolish young woman had ever heard.
She looked away, and the memory swiftly merged back into the jungle.
I do believe it's time for another turn of the spit, she said, moving back to the fire. You were lovers, Lizanne said, finding the notion scarcely conceivable. A servant and a princess trysting in the imperial sanctum. If you had been discovered... Oh, we were. Make no mistake about that.
Alastine gestured for Lizanne to take the other end of the spit, and together they turned the meat, the fire hissing and popping as grease flowed from the cuts.
We weren't even particularly discreet. It wasn't uncommon for nobles to indulge themselves with the servants. There was an unspoken tolerance for such things, life in the sanctum being so monumentally dull. But not for us. For what we had was not mere indulgence, and that made it dangerous. For a time we were left in peace. Azarel had me assigned as her personal attendant, and we lived in happy seclusion in our own little palace. She composed her music, and I designed and constructed my toys. Then came the Regency Wars.
The sound of rustling plants came again, and Lizanne looked round to see the entire clearing morphing into a grand ballroom. Huge chandeliers of glittering crystal hung from the ceiling, above a dance floor streaked in blood from the many corpses that covered it. There were men and women, infants and elderly, all dressed in the finery befitting the various ranks of Corventine nobility. From the pattern of the blood spatter, Lizanne deduced this massacre had been carried out with the blade rather than the gun.
The Coronation Day Purge,
Alastine said, sprinkling a little salt on the roasting meat.
At least half of the upper tier of imperial aristocracy wiped out in a single day. I won't go into the tedium of what led up to it. Suffice to say, a bunch of malcontent inbreds wanted to seize power from the ruling bunch of inbreds. The result was the Regency Wars, which began with all this. Azareth survived, thanks to me. I dressed her up in servant's clothes, and we managed to escape the sanctum. We took refuge in my grandparents' house, which could have been a costly mistake, it being an obvious place to look. Luckily, her uncle found her before anyone else did. He heaved her up onto a horse, and off they went. We barely had time to say goodbye, and I didn't see her again for 5 years. When I did, this is what they had made of her.
The ballroom shimmered and shifted into an even grander room of cathedralesque proportions. Tall windows rose on each side, and huge pillars supported vaulted ceilings of such height they were wreathed in mist, gathered from the thousand or more people below. They were all kneeling in abject supplication, heads pressed to the floor and arms outstretched, as they paid obeisance to a figure seated on a dais. Bazan was barely able to recognize Azareth under the mask of alabaster paint that covered her face, her features bunched by the weight of the bejeweled crown atop her head. More than that was the new hardness to her eyes. These were the eyes of her statue, the eyes of a woman who had seen and done terrible things. Too many to remain that same young woman who had once sabotaged her pianola, just for the chance to talk to someone she thought she might love.
"Emperor Azareth the First," Alastine said. "Quite impressive, isn't she?"
Lizanne saw that there was one figure amongst the multitude who was not kneeling. Alastine stood at the rear of the huge, vaulted chamber, clad in a plain muslin dress, as she stared at the newly crowned empress that official history would record as an emperor.
"This was the last time you saw her," Lizanne realized. "Yes."
Alastine didn't turn from her cookery, crouching to add some more wood to the fire.
"I was surprised to receive a formal invitation to the coronation. Somewhat frightened, in fact. But I went, nevertheless. How could I not? And I didn't kneel, which was noticed, but by then she was already so feared, none would dare voice an objection. After the ceremony, a chamberlain gave me an envelope. Inside was a large amount of money, a notification that I had been commanded by the emperor to undertake a research expedition to the continent of Kilnaria. There was also a note in her own hand. Just one line. Find me treasure."
The coronation faded into the green wall of the jungle as Alastine took a knife and cut a portion of meat from the haunch.
"I do believe this is close to done," she said,
biting off a morsel before offering it to Lizanne.
"Don't you think?"
Lizanne took the meat, putting the whole piece in her mouth, and discovering Seraph meat to be both flavorsome and tender.
"She exiled you," she said, chewing and swallowing. "She had little choice, and I believe she thought she was being kind. I had often spoken of this place, you see. Idle talk about its many mysteries as we lay together in the small hours. It was a surprise to find she was actually listening. Ah!"
She turned as fresh rustling sounded from the jungle.
"It seems our guests have arrived."
"Guests?"
"I invited a few old friends. I hope you don't mind."
Lizanne's polite response died as a figure stepped out of the jungle, a tall figure carrying a spear and a war club. His face, adorned in a black and white mottling of war paint, was the distorted, scaled, and hostile visage of a tribal spoiled. Lizanne lunged for Alastine, catching her by the wrist and tearing the knife from her grip. Lizanne whirled to face the spoiled as he dropped into a fighting crouch and charged, teeth bared in a snarl. She sidestepped the spoiled, lashing out with her knife in an attempt to sever the veins in its neck. It was too swift, however, dancing out of reach, and countering with a fast sweep of its spear, aiming for her legs. Lizanne leapt over the weapon, rolled and cast her knife at the spoiled's face, an expert throw that would have skewered it through the eye. Instead, the knife shuddered to a halt in midair, where it continued to hang.
"That's hardly the way to greet an honored guest,"
Alastine reproached her, moving to pluck the knife from the air before turning to the spoiled.
"Tree Speaker," she said, "good of you to come."
The spoiled continued to glare in challenge at Lazanne for several seconds, then abruptly straightened into a calmer posture, the hostility fading from its face.
"Maker of things,"
it greeted Alastine, speaking with such calm affability that Lazanne realized it was conforming to a preset sequence of events. This trance had been crafted with such care, it was easy to forget the entire thing was essentially a narrative dream.
"You made yourself a pet spoiled,"
Lazanne said, watching Alastine lead the tribal to the fire, where she cut him a portion of meat.
"I didn't make anything," she said with a laugh. "I merely discovered some new friends."
She inclined her head at the jungle, where more spoiled had begun to appear. There were about 50 of them, male and female, all of fighting age and carrying weapons. They were clad in a similar garb of soft, dark leather, albeit with a few individual embellishments. Some wore face paint of various hues, whilst others didn't. Some wore necklaces of bone or beads, whilst others were unadorned. She had had little opportunity to study the tribal spoiled that attacked Carvenport, but she did recall a rigid uniformity of appearance amongst the different tribal groups. Her experience during the final moments aboard the profitable venture had provided a partial explanation.
"They share minds. It's how the white controls them."
"There was a gathering,"
Tree Speaker told Alastine with grave formality.
"Your words were heard. Agreement was reached."
He pointed his spear at the temple above the trees.
"We will go with you to end what must be ended."
"And very decent of you it is, too,"
Alastine replied, handing him some meat.
"Best eat up. From what I recall, you're going to need your strength."
Lizanne spent some time in confused contemplation, gaze roaming the assembled spoiled as they came forward to share in the feast.
"Language,"
she said finally, one particular realization rising through the babble of thoughts.
"Are they speaking yours or you theirs?"
"Does it matter?"
Alastine asked, and Lazanne realized that it didn't, at least not here. In the trance, language was thought.
"But if this is a memory, you must have found a way to communicate," she persisted. "Did you change them somehow?"
Alastine gave a full, hearty laugh that lasted long enough for Lazanne to find quite aggravating.
"No,"
Alastine said when she finally sobered, shaking her head and wiping a tear from the corner of her eye.
"If anything, it was the opposite. They found me not far from here, a few years before all this. I'd had the misfortune to encounter some of their less friendly cousins, and was in rather dire need of medical attention. Tree Speaker's daughter found me, bleeding away and close to death."
She smiled fondly at the spoiled, who was now busily gorging himself on Serath flesh.
"He's a healer as well as a warrior. They have a remarkable knowledge of the healing properties of green, and all manner of medicinal herbs to be found in this jungle. They usually kill our kind when they find us. The sickened, they call us. But for me, they made an exception."
Her face took on a more serious aspect, and she turned to regard the temple.
"I think because somehow they knew we would share an important task one day."
"What's in there?"
Lizanne said, moving to her side.
"Your Empress's treasure?"
"I suppose you could call it that. The greatest treasure and the greatest danger."
She raised her gaze to the sky as a rumble of thunder sounded.
"It appears you're running out of blue, Miss Lethbridge. Do be sure to call again soon. Tell your musician friend to take a look at the Follies of Savokas.
Wait!
Bazan winced as a pulse of confusion went through her, a sense of dislocation that indicated the end of a trance.
You locked your memories in Tinkra's head for a reason. You knew we would meet. I need to know why.
You already have what you need,
Alistine said, the jungle turning to mist around her as the trance neared its terminus. She gestured at the spoiled as they transformed into vague, wisp-like ghosts.
For now, at least, I look forward to your next visit.
Chapter 16. Clay.
They should call this place Bug Area,
Lorribeth said, slapping a hand against her neck to squash yet another fly. They hung over the water in thick swarms and would plague the Lady Melinda at regular intervals as she ploughed her way north along the Quillam. Lieutenant Sigarol had the best map-reading skills amongst them and reckoned it had taken 2 days to cover some 20 miles of river. Skaggerhill blamed the current, which had a tendency to force random shifts in the boat's course, as well as impeding progress despite the efforts of her engine. As yet, there had been no change in the green wall of reeds that covered both banks. If anything, Clay thought they had grown taller as the miles wore on.
See her, damn it, you little bastards!
Lorribeth cursed, slapping at her arms and neck as the Melinda carried them through another swarm.
Cover up more,
Sigarol told her, pulling a duster from beneath his bench. He had donned a seaman's jacket to ward off the flies, finding the sweat and discomfort caused by the humid atmosphere preferable to the attentions of the insects.
In this heat?
Lorribeth said, more in resignation than protest, and she voiced no further objection as the lieutenant settled the heavy garment around her shoulders. Chris was the only member of the crew who didn't feel obliged to cover her skin, as the constant pool of smoke from the Melinda's engine proved a deterrent to the bugs. Chief Bosware's design was ingenious, but not especially efficient, being prone to emitting a variety of unpleasant miasmas, a sooty, oil-tinged smoke being the most copious.
We'll need fuel soon,
Chris told Clay, blinking at him above the handkerchief she used to shield her lungs from the engine's vapors.
At this rate, the coal will be exhausted by tomorrow afternoon.
She'd run on wood well enough,
Skaggerhill put in from the tiller, before casting a sour glance at their surroundings.
If there was any to be had round here.
How about reducing speed?
Clay asked.
Won't she burn less then? We're barely making headway as it is, Skaggerhill said. Any slower and we'll be standing still.
We could harvest some reeds,
Sigarol suggested.
They should burn.
Not enough,
Chris frowned, evidently translating the explanation in her head.
Energy. Besides, we would need to dry them out first.
Clay turned his gaze to the prow, where his uncle sat in customary unspeaking vigilance. He had barely moved from the spot so far, except to partake of a brief meal or clean his rifle.
Any guidance to offer here, Uncle?
Clay called to him.
You know this place, right?
He wasn't sure Braddon would answer. He hadn't said a word since setting off, and even Lorribeth's attempts to elicit a response had met with either noncommittal grunts or outright silence. Today, however, he seemed willing to talk.
There's an island, he said, not turning. About 10 miles on, where the river widens. It's got trees on it.
He paused and added,
Greens too, most likely.
Clay's gaze automatically began to scan the river, as it did whenever mention of greens was made. So far, they hadn't seen a single sign of any drakes, not even a ripple in the Quillam's swift-flowing surface. Even so, the sense of being observed had lingered ever since leaving the Superior. This is their place, he reminded himself. Even before the White, I doubt they appreciated visitors.
Can't be helped, he said, forcing a brisk decisiveness into his tone. It was something he noticed Halmore tended to do when things weren't going well.
There's no walking out of here. Lieutenant, how long before we make this island?
Sigurd briefly consulted his map and compass.
It's not marked on this chart, he said. But assuming it's to be found 10 miles on, we should be there by late afternoon.
Everyone clean and load your iron, Clay said. Preacher, when we get there, I want you at the prow with Uncle Braddon. You two'll kill any greens on the island. The rest of us will keep them off the boat.
True to Sigurd's calculation, the island came into view a few minutes past the 17th hour. It was formed of a narrow spit of land some 200 yards long and about 50 wide, with, Clay was relieved to see, a copse of stunted but thick-limbed trees rising from its center.
What do you see?
He asked Preacher, as Skaggahill steered them towards the eastern shore of the island. The marksman took a moment to thoroughly scan the place before replying.
Only two, starting to stir. Looks like the engine woke them up.
Take him as soon as you're sure of the shot,
Clay said, pistol in one hand and vials of red, green and black in the other, as his gaze roved the river and the banks. Braddon fired almost immediately, the shot like a thunderclap as it echoed across the water. His protectorate issue rifle had been equipped with a telescopic sight, a gift from the superior's armory, courtesy of Mr. Steelfine, enabling a clean kill even at this range. He worked the bolt and fired again, after only the slightest pause, grunting,
"Got both."
"Take us in,"
Clay told Skaggahill, then crouched to retrieve the bag of tools Chief Bosware had stowed in the lower hull. The engineer had had the foresight to include a saw and a pair of axes.
"Me and the lieutenant will gather the fuel. The rest of you watch the water."
He drank a full vial of green and nodded at Sigurd to do the same. They leapt clear of the Melinda, as Skaggahill grounded her on the island's sandy eastern bank, rushing into the trees in search of the most easily harvested timber. Sigurd chose a sapling and set about its trunk with the axe, hacking through it in less than a minute. Clay found a more thickly bodied tree farther in, the trunk too broad to be felled, but with a number of easily severed branches. By the time the green wore off, they had amassed a considerable pile of wood, albeit of less than regular proportions.
"Guess carpentry ain't your strong suit,"
Skaggahill observed, eyeing the pile in amusement.
"We'll saw it up on the boat,"
Clay said, gathering logs into his arms.
"Lend a hand here, will you?"
They had piled most of the wood onto the boat when he heard a commotion in the trees. Recognizing Loriabeth's voice raised in anger and alarm, Sigurd immediately snatched up his carbine and charged into the undergrowth, Clay and the others close behind.
"Just stop it, Pa! Please!"
They found Loriabeth in a small clearing, staring at her father in shocked misery, tears shining in her eyes. Braddon stood a short distance away, hefting something in his hands. Something small that wriggled and screeched as he swung it up and then down. The screeching abruptly ceased as the thing's head made contact with a boulder, the skull cracking open to spill blood and brains. A chorus of screeches dragged Clay's gaze from the grisly sight to a pair of infant greens. They scrabbled about in a nest, surrounded by the remnants of their scorched shells, hides shifting color in distress. "Only just hatched," Clay realized, as his uncle bent to retrieve one of the infants, grabbing it by the hind legs and swinging it up and back.
"Uncle!"
Clay said, wincing as the infant's head connected with the boulder, its brains mixing with that of its sibling. Loriabeth let out a sob and took an involuntary step towards her father, fists balled. Clay caught her before she could launch herself at Braddon, who barely seemed to notice.
"That's enough, Uncle,"
Clay said, as Braddon tossed the dead infant aside and reached for the last one. He appeared deaf to Clay's words, tearing his arm away as Clay reached for him.
Captain!
Skaggerhill had arrived at the clearing and stood staring at the scene, eyes wide and appalled.
It's time for them to die, Skeks,
Braddon said, reaching for the final infant.
All of them. Contract is code,
Skaggerhill said, stepping forward to grip Braddon by the shoulders. The harvester gave a brief shake of his captain's shoulders.
Younguns are left be. Else what are we gonna hunt in days to come? Time for hunting's over,
Braddon replied, face seeing a strange emptiness in his uncle's eyes as he regarded Skaggerhill.
It's time for slaughter now. Ain't no room in this world for both us and them. The thing that commands them sees it. Time we did too.
He tried to shrug off Skaggerhill's hands, but the harvester held on, a certain desperate bafflement creeping into his voice as he said,
This ain't you, Captain, and it ain't us.
His words were abruptly drowned out by the flat crack of a long rifle from the direction of the boat, followed soon after by a flurry of pistol shots.
Greens, Clay said. Get back to the Melinda.
Sigurol and Lauriabeth immediately sprinted off, followed by Skaggerhill after a brief, hesitant glance at Braddon, who stood unmoving, gaze locked on the squalling infant drake. It had calmed now and stared up at its would-be murderer, yellow eyes blinking as it let out a series of chirps, small tail sweeping from side to side.
Let's go, Uncle,
Clay said, his voice pitched just below a shout. Braddon took a step towards the infant, boot raised.
I said let's go!
Clay stepped between his uncle and the drake, meeting his gaze and finding the previous emptiness replaced with dark, quivering fury.
Since when do you command me, boy?
Braddon demanded in a low voice. Clay looked over his shoulder as another volley of shots sounded from the direction of the Melinda.
We ain't got time for it,
he began, turning back to take his uncle's fist in the face. As he landed flat on his back, tasting blood and blinking away stars, he at least had the satisfaction of seeing the infant green scamper off into the undergrowth.
This is my company,
Braddon said, advancing towards him, fist pulled back for another punch. He let out a pained grunt as Clay jackknifed, lashing out with both boots to catch his uncle in the chest. Clay rolled to his feet and swung a punch into Braddon's jaw, hard enough to set him back a step or two.
Not anymore,
Clay said, jabbing another blow at his uncle's nose, drawing blood.
Not since you gave it up to wallow in the shit of your misery.
He lashed out again, catching Braddon on the chin, and followed up with a three-punch combination to the body that left the older man stooped and winded.
It's my company now.
Another punch, blood flying from Braddon's lips as he reeled away.
You ain't nothing no more, old man!
A right hook to the side of the head, Braddon staggering, about to fall.
Aunt Freda would be ashamed!
Braddon's arm moved in a blur as Clay's fist swung again, blocking the blow before taking hold of his arm. He delivered a punch of his own to Clay's gut, doubling him over, before hoisting him up and tossing him into the bushes. Clay groaned, clutching at his aching midriff as he tried to fill his winded lungs. After a few ragged breaths, he managed to roll over and began to push himself upright, then saw his uncle striding towards him with a drawn pistol.
Shit, thought Clay. Guess I finally made him mad enough to kill me.
Braddon brought the pistol level with his chest and fired, left hand fanning the hammer as he loosed off a rapid salvo. Clay heard something heavy hit the ground behind him and turned to see a fully grown aquatic green lying dead a short distance away, its hide continuing to flicker as it twitched. His gaze swung back to his uncle, now calmly but swiftly slotting cartridges into his revolver. He met Clay's eyes, sighed, and stooped to offer him a hand.
If you're gonna hit a man, he said,
Make sure you put him down with the first blow. Clay took the prophet's hand and held himself upright, drawing his revolver and following as his uncle set off for the boat at a run. They found it wreathed in gunsmoke, with several green corpses littering the surrounding sandbank. Chris had already stoked the engine to full power, and Skaggerhill sat at the tiller, beckoning urgently for them to get aboard. Clay fixed his gaze on the boat and accelerated into a sprint, refusing to look back as a chorus of enraged growls erupted behind. Preacher stood at the prow of the boat, rifle at his shoulder, and apparently aimed at Clay's head. He instinctively jerked to the side, but Preacher had already fired, the bullet whipping past Clay's ear like an angry hornet before finding its target. Skaggerhill had drawn the Melinda a few yards away from the bank to get her clear of the sand, so they were obliged to wade through the last few yards. Preacher and Sigurol kept up a steady barrage as Chris and Lorriabeth helped haul Clay and Bratton aboard. Once they lay gasping on the deck, Chris engaged the propeller, setting the boat into forward motion.
"They get you?"
Lorriabeth asked, her gaze switching from Clay's bloodied face to that of her father.
"Ran into a tree,"
Clay replied, wiping blood from his nose and getting to his feet. He looked back at the island, finding it overrun with greens, all howling a chorus of rage in their high-pitched, almost bird-like voices. A few slipped into the water in pursuit, but soon fell behind thanks to the Melinda's speed, aided by the reduced current, which seemed to be less swift in this stretch of river.
"Why ain't they coming for us?"
Bratton wondered, frowning in puzzlement.
"Thought the White wants us dead."
"I don't think the White's got hold of them right now," Clay said, recalling the nest and the infant greens. "They're just defending the place where their young'uns get hatched." He sat down, taking a canteen and tipping some of the contents over his face to wash away the rest of the blood. He had a lingering ache in his gut and a swelling below his eye, but it looked like his uncle had spared him any permanent damage or lost teeth. Bratton, it turned out, hadn't been so lucky. Clay watched him take the bench opposite and open his mouth wide, reaching inside to pluck out a tooth. He gave Clay a sour glance before tossing it over the side. Clay winced at a sudden upsurge of pain in his gut. He extracted a vial of green from his wallet and took a quarter sip before offering it to his uncle.
"Won't grow a new tooth, but it'll take away the pain and heal the hole."
Bratton shrugged and accepted the vial, taking a small sip before tipping the entire contents down his throat. He sat for a time, jaws clenched against the burn of the green.
"So, Captain," he said eventually, "there's still a great deal of country betwixt us and Crystalline Lake. You got any notion of what we're going to do when we get to the end of this river?"
Clay gave a humorless grin.
"Was kind of hoping you did, Captain."
Seen through the lens of a spyglass, the Serath seemed small at first, Clay initially concluding they were of horse-like dimensions, albeit with a longer neck and more sturdy body and legs. It was only when one of them began grazing on the upper leaves of a tree that he gained a true impression of their size.
"At least a third again bigger than the biggest horse I ever saw," he said, handing the spyglass back to his uncle. "You really think we can tame these beasts?"
"Tame them, no," Bratton said. "But you can ride them."
"You sure, Pa?"
Lorriabeth asked, shielding her eyes to view the Serath herd.
"Seem a little rambunctious to me."
Clay surveyed the herd once more, seeing two of the larger beasts squaring up for a confrontation. They both pawed the ground with their forehooves, heads lowered as they bellowed out a challenge that could be heard even at this distance. After a lengthy period of bellowing and earth scraping, the Serath charged at each other, dust billowing across the plain as they met. They fought by rearing up and assailing one another with their hooves, reminding Clay of inexpert drunks fighting in a blinds bar.
The combat was brief, if loud. One Sereth, abruptly abandoning the fight to gallop away a short distance. Its opponent chased it for a short time, then veered off, spending a few moments to call out in triumph, before returning to the business of grazing on the long grass that seemed to dominate the southern plains.
"That's the bull," Braddon said. "He's the one we want."
The Lady Melinda had come to a grinding halt in the shallows of the Upper Quillam 2 days before, forcing them to proceed on foot. They cut reeds to camouflage her, there being the faint possibility that a spoil might happen upon her in their absence. Hauling their gear and Chris's apparatus across the marsh to the plains had been both tedious and exhausting. The spongy, bug-infested land seemed to go on forever, and their feet suffered from the constant damp. By the time the marsh gave way to firm grasslands, Clay had to order an extended halt just to dry out their feet. Consequently, he had welcomed his uncle's suggestion that they ride rather than walk to Crystalline Lake. But now he wasn't so sure. Still, it was an awfully long way.
"All right," he said. "How's this done?"
"Sereth's a herd animal," Braddon said a short time later. He led Clay towards the herd with a purposeful stride, making no effort at concealment.
"The bull's the leader, and the rest are so loyal they'll follow him over a cliff. Curious thing about these beasts is they get all docile-like once you're on their back. Met a naturalist fella in Covenport once, said it was to do with their size. They're so big nothing of any weight ever sits on them. Even the drakes don't land on them when they hunt the herds. Blacks'll pin them to the ground, and reds'll roast their legs so's they can't run off. So when something gets astride them, they get set in a state of scared confusion. Thing is," he paused and came to a halt, turning and handing Clay a length of coiled rope. "Only ever seen this done by a bloodblessed. Us normal folk are just too slow."
Clay looked at the bull, which by now had noticed their approach. The other Sereth was slowly gathering behind him as he stared at the two small interlopers, jaws grinding on a mouthful of grass and one foreleg stamping the ground.
"That's a warning sign," Braddon said, although Clay hadn't really needed the explanation.
At this remove, the bull seemed much larger than his first estimation, and it was hard to credit being able to control such a beast just by virtue of landing on its back.
"It has to be him, huh?"
he asked Braddon, reaching for his wallet.
"Yep. Try landing on one of the smaller ones, and the others will just run off and leave it. Be sure to loop that rope around his neck soon as you can."
Clay took a vial of green from his wallet, drank it all, then, after a moment's consideration, drank another. He waited for the product to flood his system, feeling his limbs thrum with it as he focused on the bull. The animal clearly sensed an increased level of danger, for it let out a bellow, head lowering and forehooves pouring. Clay set off at a sprint, green enhanced speed making the grassland blur around him as he sped towards the bull. It bellowed again and charged to meet the challenge. Time seemed to slow as Clay closed with the animal, the dust it raised from the plain ascending in gentle clouds, and the huge muscles of its legs quivering. After covering the last few yards, it planted both forehooves on the ground and spun, lashing out with its hind legs. Clay dived and rolled under the flailing hooves, coming to a halt as the bull whirled to face him. They stared at each other for a second, separated by a distance of barely 10 feet. The Sereth shook its mighty head, eyes narrowed in wary contemplation of its foe. Unwilling to allow it the time to launch another attack, Clay surged into a sprint once more, covering the distance in 2 strides and leaping as high as his enhanced strength would allow. He turned head over heels in midair, twisting with an acrobat's precision to bring himself down squarely on the bull's back. Then let out a painful grunt as the bull dodged aside and he landed hard on the ground. The bull roared and reared above him, hooves rising for a killing stamp, then froze. The beast's roar choked off in its throat as it continued to stand there on its hind legs, immobile as a statue.
"Looked like you needed some help."
Clay looked round to see